Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. Today I'm joined by our man in Benoni, Mr. Marius Root. Marius, how are you doing?
How's Nick? How's it going?
It's going all right. And we're, excuse me, we're also joined today by Dr. John Endres, the CEO of the Institute of Race Relations. John, how are you?
I'm very well, thanks. Thanks for having me back on, Nick.
Always a pleasure, sir. But then again, you are my boss, so I have to say that. Our first order of business, just before we get into the news of today, the IRR is going to be in KZN next week. So, John, do you want to just tell us a little bit about what you will be doing down there in KZN and the opportunity of maybe people to come and see you in person?
Yes. In the flesh, so to speak, Gabriel and I will be down in KZN from the 16th to the 18th of November for meetings, and we would also like to meet Daily Friend viewers, readers, friends of the Institute, and just have a chat. So we'll be in Harwick, I think, on the 16th, in Umhlanga on the 17th. We've got venues in both of those places, and invite you, as our viewers, to come and join us. We'll give a little bit of a presentation on where we see our politics and the state of the nation, and then look forward to having a chat with you.
So I will put in the YouTube comments a pinned post with the venues and such, but both of these events will be at 6 o'clock. The one will be just north of Howick at the tap in the tap room at Midlands Fable on 85 Curry's Post Road. And that'll be on the 16th of November at 6. And then the second event will be in Umhlanga at on the 17th of November, also at 6 o'clock, at Garden Court in Umhlanga, corner Aurora, Centenary Boulevard, and in meeting room 1 and 2. But I'll put that just down below. Come say hello to us, listen to our presentation. I think you'll find it interesting, enlightening, enjoyable. We hope to see all of our KZN fans there. So with that out of the way, let us get into the news. And the first one is a report by a group based in Cape Town called Yazi, who say that South Africa is in danger of a major uprising due to load shedding. Now, I guess the first question that comes to mind is, kind of seems like this would have happened already, because there's one thing that really annoys people. It is load shedding. But this group wanted to quantify that a little bit better. So they went into various places around the country, particularly in townships and metros, talking to people between the ages of 18 and 51. Who earned between 500 and 6,000 rand a month, and asked them their thoughts on load shedding. They found that more than 89 members of what they call, what they classified as members of the informal economy, believe that continued load shedding blackouts will lead to a national uprising, including acts of chaos, strikes, and looting, perhaps something somewhat similar to what we saw in the July riots last year. These various informal traders said that they had losses ranging from 1,000 to 5,000 rand a month in income, and in many cases this was a halving of the income that they were living off of, and this was aggravated by September load shedding, which was really difficult. 24% of the respondents said they were unable to work for more than 6 hours a day, and 75% said they could not get to work on time due to traffic lights not working. And of course, we know that the situation at Eskom, while things are not as bad as they were a few weeks ago, in terms of what stage of load shedding we're on now, there doesn't seem to be any end in sight to load shedding. And of course, the next time that we have multiple failures, we may be back in stage 6, or who knows, maybe even a higher level of load shedding. So, John, let me start with you. We've heard this sort of cliche about South Africa, which says that South Africa is a ticking time bomb. And the way the argument goes is usually something like this. They say, look, we've got all these unemployed young people in particular. Our youth unemployment is very high, way over 50%. We've got just general levels of unemployment and poverty and inequality. We've got all of these social forces pushing people to be very unhappy. We've got a weak police force. It's only a matter of time before we see some sort of massive national uprising, and then the rest of where that goes is always sort of left a little bit confused. You know, are we going to get some new sort of revolutionary government? Is the ANC going to change policy? It's never really clear how this argument goes. But do you agree with the assessment here of some of these people that we are headed for some sort of quote unquote national uprising?
Well, I think our colleague Michael Morris made a good point in an earlier show that South Africans are remarkably tolerant and patient, and that certainly seems to be the case. We're willing to put up with a lot of stuff before we get really angry and start breaking things. But I think South Africans are beginning to break things at an increasing rate out of frustration. So if you look at the police statistics on unrest and protest, you can see that the share of all those protests that is violent has been increasing over time. It used to be around 8% 10, 15 years ago. And by now we're at a stage where about one third of all the protests are violent in South Africa. So I do think that the patience of South Africans is being stretched very, very far. And the uprising in July last year showed us that a major outburst was possible. And because we're not seeing the underlying factors really changing to any significant extent, as you laid them out, the unemployment, the poverty, the lack of growth in the economy, the lack of prospects for young people and for the poor, because those factors remain in place, I do think that the risk of an uprising also continues to exist. I think in terms of the sample group that was interviewed for the study that you mentioned, it may be not necessarily so much that there's some inside knowledge there about something about to blow up, but I think it certainly reflects the fears of people who are vulnerable. You know, if you're an informal trader, you get harassed by the police, you get squeezed from all sides. You know, the rising cost of fuel, rising cost of your inputs, the precarious nature of your business makes you really exposed to any kind of disruption. And the Eskom situation is just an added problem on top of that. So I really understand these people and how exposed they feel, how vulnerable they feel, and how worried they are about unrest. Also partly see that in political polling, when we wonder why people don't switch their votes to a different party away from the ANC, one of the reasons is that precise fear of unrest and violence, where they say, look, with the ANC, as bad as they are, at least we know what we've got. But we're really worried that if we vote for a different party, the ANC members themselves might also become violent. You know, and if you think about KZN last year, the reason for that violence or the trigger ultimately was a factional dispute within the ruling party. So, yeah, I think those concerns are well-founded. And I also feel that the study was very valuable in the sense that it gave us a perspective on the impact of load shedding that we maybe usually don't engage with so much. You know, we tend to think of the big factories and the mines and the office towers and how they are affected by load shedding. But of course, the people, the informal traders, are also very badly affected. And in many ways, they have less ability to respond to that and to do something about it. Nicholas?
No, that's exactly right. You know, you think of an informal trader and you might think, oh, well, they're selling on the side of the road. How does the lack of electricity affect them? Well, they often bake or prepare their goods beforehand, maybe sometimes even in a home oven. And, you know, you can't do that if you don't have electricity. So it really does hurt their bottom line. Morris, one of the interesting things I think about the July riot was how, while there was definitely this sort of political spark and there were, I think, at least some activities by the kind of maybe pro-Zumarites, particularly in KZN, to cause chaos and mischief and that, it seemed like a lot of the riots really didn't have that much of a political content. It sort of became a groupthink, nihilistic, take what you can, every man for himself kind of thing. And a lot of the more, I think, interesting political developments were not so much on the side of who was doing the uprising, but who was resisting it. And how there was this kind of coalition of people from all across South African society, both rich and poor, black, white, Indian, whatever, pushing back to defend property. Do you think that if there is some kind of repeat of the July riots, there'll be more political content this time, that there'll be more of a movement, or will it be as nihilistic as the previous one?
Yeah, I think it'll be as nihilistic as the previous one. I think, as I say, I think the spark for what caused the July riots last year was as John says, factional battles within the governing party. But there was no direction or anything like it. People were talking about it was this insurrection and all this kind of thing. I don't really think it was. You know, if it was a true insurrection, it would have seen, you know, airport being taken over, the SABC building in Durban, or, you know, the Premier's office in Pietermaritzburg, whatever. And it wasn't, as you say, it was just this kind of nihilistic free-for-all kind of thing that happened. And I think for a lot of people, I mean, we saw some, there was a clip that going around, a guy stopped his new fancy Merc and got out and helped loot Woolworths. But I think a lot of that looting was also people who, you know, they're probably struggling to put food on the table every day. This was their opportunity where they saw they could actually get something nice. Obviously, you can't condone it. But, you know, if somebody hasn't had a proper meal for 2 weeks or whatever the case is, or, you know, well, lives in a terrible place.
For me, the piece of media which most represents the July riots was a guy who filmed himself while a Macro, I think it was being looted, or it was a spa or something. And there was a cake, and he filmed himself smashing his face into the cake and eating it without his hands. And you could see that he was just deliriously caught up in the excitement of the crowd. And there was nothing else there. He was there for cake, and that was it.
Exactly. So obviously it's not something you can condone, but obviously with South Africa's socioeconomic problems, this kind of thing, you know, just needs this kind of spark. But I'm also skeptical of if we'll see kind of like a Arab Spring and whatever. You, for all South Africa's problems, we are still a democracy. You can still say what you want. You still can go vote every 5 years or whatever the case is. But an issue is, I think, a lot of people who are upset with the ANC or used to be ANC voters or whatever the case is, as we were saying earlier, simply they don't want to go vote for anybody else, whatever the reason might be, because they're worried what the ANC might do if they lose power, or, you know, they just don't see that there's anybody worth voting for. Or I remember a colleague of ours, I think Gareth van Orten, said something along these lines, that an ANC voter, often when they do decide to change allegiance, it goes from firstly they abstain and then they go vote for a different party. And I think if you do look at voting patterns, especially in metros, we have seen that the ANC vote has hemorrhaged quite badly. For example, in Johannesburg, in 2011, the ANC got about 60% of the votes in the local government election. In last year's local government election, they didn't even get a third of the votes. Even if you add them to the, even if you add the EFF vote to the ANC, which you could say, you know, it's like, you know, basically the same organization, still barely gets about 40% of the vote. So people do change their vote. And I think what happened in KwaZulu-Natal was a very good example. I think part of the reason why the ANC barely got 40% in eThekwini was because of the riots and so on in July, and also why the ANC lost so much support across KwaZulu-Natal, and probably why they're going to lose the province in 2024. So, yeah, I think there's – I don't know if these riots actually had a political element to them, but I think they do have consequences for our politics. And just on this Yazi, the article about this organization, they said they're going to release some polling about how load shedding affects people's voting choices, which I'll be very interested to see. Apparently, before the 2019 election, there was a directive from the ANC or Luthuli House or whatever to ESCOM that you cannot let the lights go out. We use as much diesel as you can. We have to keep the lights on before the election, because if the lights go out, we're going to lose a lot of votes. So it'll be interesting to see how load shedding does affect how people decide to vote.
No, definitely. I think the inability of the government to deal with it. I mean, that's one of the good things I think to look forward to in 2024, is that there will at least be an attempt to give us less load shedding, even if it comes at a long-term cost. John, do you have any final thoughts on this topic and the question of a national uprising?
No, I think we've covered it pretty well. But yeah, always worthwhile keeping in mind, you know, the ordinary people. Think about people who are different from yourself and how they are affected. But also, there was a report, I think, last week or this week from ESCOM saying that the next 5 years, they're expecting more load shedding. So it's not looking like the problem is going away. It looks like we're going to be stuck with it for a while longer.
Definitely. And I think that until the political problem around ESCOM is solved, we're not going to see the reforms that we need to take place. Still, there has been some good stuff coming out of finance, which I'm sure we're going to talk about this week sometime with regards to procurement. Yeah, that's a story for another day. Okay. Gauteng's metros are very troubled at the moment. As anyone who's been following the news closely will know, particularly Johannesburg and Ekurhuleni have been viciously fought over by a coalition of, on one hand, the DA, Action SA, and a number of the other sort of smaller traditional opposition parties, and on the other hand, the ANC, EFF, and with a couple of parties, and parties like the ATM. And then in between are a couple of parties like the Patriotic Alliance, who seem to sort of swap between the two sides as it suits them. But all of this seems to be leading to increasing problems in these municipalities. So there's the last week we did talk about this on the show. There was an inability to elect a new mayor because apparently the EFF and ANC couldn't agree on a candidate, and both parties need the other in order to secure the vote in Ekurhuleni. According to some reporting, there's now massive amounts of trash piling up in certain areas, and there seems to be no one at the helm to fix the problem. At the same time, the South African Local Government Association, SALGA, claims that both Johannesburg and Ekurhuleni are in serious financial trouble. They said that the Ekurhuleni Metro opened with 1.8 billion rand in its coffers, and was in the red by 1.4 billion rand during the same period. This equated to a combined negative balance of 2.276 billion for that and Joburg. And SALGA basically implied that this financial situation had come about because of opposition misgovernance, although SALGA is supposed to be neutral. The Joburg Finance MMC, Julie Subedi, who is from, I think she's from the DA. Oh yeah, I remember, she was in council with me. Sorry, Julie. Said that, dismissed these reports. SALGA went on to say this financial shortfall was going to cause problems, and that they would not be able to, that Joburg would not be able to pay its staff properly over the next few months. The DA MMC for finance disputed this, saying that she had a number of reports, another number of problems with this report, saying that not only was SALGA not actually supposed to have this information because it hasn't been released to the public yet, but further to that, that the numbers that they did release were completely wrong, and that while there were some wobbles in some of the cash flow, and that the city was not in a great financial state, it was definitely going to be able to pay all of its staff. At the same time, in Paul Palazzo, who's the mayor, and presumably until the next council meeting is held and the ANC and EFF throw her out, said, while finances are not in the best position, we are actively taking steps to rectify this. And that anxiety about imminent non-payment of salaries is a fabrication. So Morris, what do you make of all this going on? There's sort of this dispute about whether the metros are in big financial problems. It's clear that they are in a bit of financial problems. I know because Paul Palazzo also, I believe today, has put forward a motion in council to take a large loan, which is being opposed by the ATM in particular, although I think they only have one council seat, but presumably the ANC will also oppose it. What do you make of this whole mess?
It's hard to work out what's happening through the noise and so on. One thing on the ANC EFF issue in Ekurhuleni. Just before the show, I saw a tweet, and I can't find it, unfortunately, saying she's back, and hashtag Tanya Campbell, in a photo of Tanya Campbell. So I don't know if that means she's actually won the mayor election again, because apparently there were three candidates, and EFF candidates, ANC candidates, and Tanya Campbell, and the EFF candidate withdrew. So this might be good news for people who are worried about a putative ANC-EFF alliance. If they can't even decide on a mayoral candidate together, that might mean the two parties are going to find it quite difficult to work together. And I think there are probably quite a lot of elements within the ANC that don't want to work with the EFF, because they know that could, EFF could probably run rings around a lot of people in the ANC and do a kind of a reverse takeover. But yeah, just on the issues of metros and so on, I think these things are very complex things to run. And the Joburg budget, for example, I'm open to correction, but I wouldn't be surprised if it's bigger than the entire Northern Cape's budget. So it's a very complex organization, lots of money around. And it's also not something that's easy to turn around quickly. We've seen this happen in other countries, and this is also a warning for South African opposition parties. Even once you manage to take over a metro from the ANC, whatever the case is, even if you don't need to do it in a coalition, often the things have been degraded so badly, it's so difficult to turn around. And by the time the next election comes, People might think, well, nothing changed under these new guys. Might as well just give the ANC another go. This has happened in other countries where opposition coalitions have taken over from governing parties. Often governing parties come back because voters just, you know, they don't see that the opposition did much. And I think this could easily happen in South Africa too, where even if the ANC does lose power at a national level, depending how the ANC holds together, if it does lose power, we could easily see that, you know, the Wild Dogs coalition takes over, even governs for the full 5 years. But people vote as much as see, oh, nothing's really changed. Might as well just let the ANC back in. We don't have to worry about these coalitions and so on. And I think we've seen this in a couple of municipalities across South Africa. It's definitely something to watch out for. But yeah, I don't think I envy anybody who's trying to run metros in South Africa. I think it's quite a hard job.
I see the Citizen is now reporting that Tanya Campbell has been re-elected. So it seems that the ANC EFF really didn't come to a deal, which I think is very interesting. And I'm probably going to actually be writing on that later today. John, what do you make of all this? There's this sort of argument abroad that our metros are in such a state. This is kind of that a very pessimistic outlook that says that, you know, there's so many problems with the sort of staff culture, with the lack of skills, with the entrenched corruption, with the lack of money, it's essentially impossible to fix these metros. What's your take on all that?
Well, I think a large part of the problem here is the willingness of residents to pay. If you think back all the way to the rent boycotts in the 1980s, I think already a culture was being established in some parts of the city where you didn't pay your rates or didn't pay for electricity, et cetera, et cetera. Getting back out of that, getting people to opt into paying again, is very difficult, as we see, for example, with the very large debt that Soweto owes Eskom. People have become very used to not paying and would prefer to keep things the way they are. In terms of rates, what we're also seeing is that residents in Johannesburg certainly are increasingly becoming vocal about what value they're getting for their money and beginning to question whether they should continue paying their rates or whether they shouldn't rather pool their resources within their area, whatever suburb it might be, and fix stuff themselves. And that is a huge risk, again, to, you know, keeping a city like Johannesburg running, because it depends to a very large extent on cross-subsidization between richer and poorer parts of town. And if the richer parts of town don't get services and stop paying, there's going to be a problem. There was an email recently from the city of Johannesburg to residents, which I was very surprised to receive, that admonished me as a ratepayer in Johannesburg to pay my rates and said, you know, if you don't pay your rates, then we can't provide services. But as one of the ratepayers who's not getting very good services, my inclination was to respond, well, you know, why don't you deliver first? And then I'll think about whether I want to continue paying or not. So yeah, you do get into this very difficult situation, very dangerous situation as well, which will present a large barrier, I think, to the success of reform governments, be that metropolitan, municipal, or national level. But ultimately, there's no way around it. You have to address this problem and solve it if you want to make it work. This is like priming a pump. You know, you need to get some water into the pump first so you can start the process of getting water flowing through it. And in this case, money plays the role of the water. You need to make sure you've got the resources to fix things. And then you can create that virtuous cycle of increasing revenue and increasing services and much with better outcomes. Of course, it also affects the investment climate in the city. If the services are breaking down, there's not enough money, businesses also won't want to invest. They'll think that they won't be taken seriously. Infrastructure won't be maintained. And so they might prefer not to invest in that city. So it's really critical getting this right.
Indeed, indeed. All right, let's move on to our last topic for today. And this is the question of devolution of powers. So on Friday last week, DA leader John Steenhuisen had a piece published in various places, including on Politics Web, saying that it's very important now that government actually begins devolving more powers to the various provinces of South Africa. And his focus is, of course, on the DA-run Western Cape. He started off his piece by saying, quoting the Deputy Chief Justice, who said that the revolution has failed, say, since the revolution has failed, let's maybe try devolution. He claims that devolution will massively improve the lives of all those who live in the Western Cape, especially the poor. He said that if local governments, in particular, he touted that the DA's local governance in the Western Cape were able to actually run the police services, for example, and passenger rail. They would be able to better serve the communities, and this would disproportionately benefit the poor, because the poor are the ones who rely the most on government services, whether that be for transport or for grants or for police protection, because they can't afford private security. He said that devolution would make it easier for citizens to hold public officials accountable and bring on board more resources by enabling collaboration between government and local community groups. He said that this would also be in South Africa's interest, as the better run the provinces are, the more tax and generation there is for the whole country, and the more jobs will be created that will sort of soothe some of the social tensions that we've been experiencing over the last few decades. He also addressed the argument of secession, saying that devolution is the most important step in order to avoid secession. He said, quote, "Far from being a stepping stone to secession, devolution will decrease the pressure for this. As the South African state fails, so for the calls for Cape independence ramp up. Far better to release that pressure through devolution than secession. Ultimately, it's not the route, but the outcome that people care about. They want to know that there is a better future for themselves and their children where they live. Devolution is an achievable, realistic path to the progress they want to see." John, is he right about devolution?
I thought that it was a very thoughtful and useful piece from John Steenhuisen. I think he's quite right about it. And it also illustrates, you know, this fact we have in South Africa of some great ironies and counterintuitive results and contradictions that emerge out of policy. And the example I like to think of here is how CADA deployment was an ANC policy designed to strengthen the hold of the ANC over the state. But the effect has been to weaken the hold of the ANC over the state, because it has been so inept at running things that people now are stopping to vote for the ANC. So it achieved the exact opposite of what the ANC wanted it to achieve. And in terms of devolution and the centralization of powers, the same thing can happen, where the more adamant the central government or the ANC is about not devolving powers and keeping things under its own control, the more likely it is going to lose precisely that control. And in that case, you might, instead of devolution, as a matter of fact, get secession, which is certainly not what the central government wants. And the counterintuitive response here is that the central government does need to let go of some of its control and assign some of that to the Western Cape, for example, which will strengthen the cohesion within the country, even though it might not at face value seem like it. But I think it's a very good argument that John Steenhuisen raises there, quite right. And of course, you also want the well-run provinces to serve as centers of excellence for the rest of the country to use, you know, as role models, as inspiration, as an example of how things can be done right and can improve instead of being subjected to continuous decline, as they appear to be when you're living here in the north of the country. Nicholas.
Maurice, what do you make of all this?
Yeah, I think I've said it before. I think South Africa missed a trick by not being a more federal state in 1910. I think it was a mistake to already be a unitary state then. We missed another trick in 1994 when we had this kind of quasi-federal system that we do have, sort of federal, but not really. And I think the DA must just be careful not to say, you know, or not least perception emerge that they only want devolution for the Western Cape. I think especially, for example, in KwaZulu-Natal, there'd probably be quite a big push for devolution as well. And, you know, I think John is perfectly, he's exactly right. Pushing against things like devolution is going to backfire for the government. And it's counterintuitive, but the more devolution actually often results in, you know, kind of centrifugal forces in a country being kept in check. There's a school of thought that the reason why India has held together, obviously apart from the great partition of when Pakistan left India, but apart from that, India's managed to keep together with over a billion people. There's no real secessionist movements in India. And school of thought is that because in India, when people, like, we want to run our own affairs, the Indian central government, that's fine. We'll create a state for you. You guys can do whatever you want. I mean, there's a state in India. It's only got about about 1 or 2 million people. It's a Christian majority state. It's called Nagaland in the east. And people there are allowed to run their affairs how they want, but they are still Indians. They're still part of the Indian state, but they get they have devolved powers. They run their own schools and all that kind of thing. And people, they're happy to still fall under the Indian central government because they're not, they feel like they're not being, you know, forced to do anything they don't want to do. And I think that's why India has, as I say, managed to keep together, given, I mean, it's got so many languages, ethnic groups, you know, even religions, even though Hinduism is obviously dominant there. And I think that's the issue in South Africa. The ANC overall is such a, you know, controlling and centralizing instinct. And but I think that's, it's going to backfire. I think devolution is probably inevitable in South Africa. And if you actually want to fight against something like secession, one of the ways to do it is actually to devolve powers, I think. I mean, it's a counterfactual, but perhaps if Scotland hadn't been given its own parliament in 1997, there would have been an even bigger push for Scotland to leave the United Kingdom 20 years later. Maybe the UK would already have broken up by now. Obviously, that's a counterfactual, but it's something to think about.
Definitely. All right. That is all the time we have for today. We hope that you found the show interesting and enjoyable, and we will be back tomorrow on the Daily Friend Show. Cheers, everyone, and have a great one.